Well, we find ourselves in James chapter 1, and we'll complete the first chapter next week. We'll start with James chapter 1, verse 8 again, which we covered last week, where it says, "A double-souled man is unstable in all his ways." And as we've been going through James, we've been bouncing back and forth between James's letter here and the Sermon on the Mount. Remember, Yeshua and James, whose real name is Jacob, James and Yeshua were half-brothers. And the core teaching of the early Messianic community was the Sermon on the Mount. People had this memorized, every single word. They spoke about it, they commented on it, they talked about it, they tried to live it out. It was the core of everything that they believed and taught. And so what we're going to discover as we go through James, if you haven't noticed this already, James's book and the Sermon on the Mount are parallel books. They intertwine. James is a commentary, and it's an opening up of the Sermon on the Mount. So we'll be going back and forth all the time. So if we go back to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, we'll start with verse 19. James is about to talk about the rich man and the poor man, and what the attitude of the rich man should be, the attitude of the poor man. And this, I'm sure, is what was on James's mind as he thought about Matthew chapter 6, starting with verse 19. "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal." In other words, don't lay up for yourselves treasures in the temporal realm. Now, we all have possessions in the temporal realm. Do not turn them into treasures. Don't make them your identity. Don't make them the thing that you truly work for. "But store for yourselves treasures in the invisible realm in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So that if your eye is clear, if your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is evil..." Now, the evil eye in Jewish Hebraic thought means greed. A clear eye, a good eye, means generosity, and an evil eye means greed. So you have to understand the terminology being used here. "If your eye is evil, your whole body be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters." So don't be double-souled. You can't serve two masters. "For either you will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth," God and money. Now, all of us here pretty much have jobs, or are trying to get a job. But you must understand, you never take a job to work for the paycheck. You take the job, you work for your employer to make your employer successful. That is the godly attitude. You serve the employer as a servant to make him successful, out of love for him, love for her. I don't care if they despitefully use you. I don't care if they mistreat you. That's not the deal. You work for them to make them successful. Let the money take care of itself. But if you go to work only for the sake of the money, not only will you be a bad employee, but you're trying to serve two masters. Because if you're working for the money, what you're saying is, and you have to know this in your heart, I don't know if this is the case with you, you have to look in your own heart. If you're working just for the money, then your faith isn't in God. Your faith is in a paycheck. And that means when the paycheck's taken away, your life crashes. Don't do that. And Yeshua gives us some clear instruction about this. This is one of the longest passages where he dwells on one topic, anywhere in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, anywhere in his speech, this is one of the longest passages where he talks about one thing and one thing only. It says, "No one can serve two masters, for either will hate the one and love the other." Because you see, if you're serving God, and we have a heart for serving God, but we're serving money because we have a heart for money. We like money. If you're trying to work for both, it's guaranteed that one will encroach upon the other. And you decide which one wins. If your love for God is greatest, it will encroach upon your money making. It will encroach upon the opportunities for more employment, for a raise, for overtime. It will encroach upon it. Are you willing to seek Him before you seek the overtime, the extra pay? Or if your love for money is greater, it will encroach upon your time for God, for serving Him, for serving His people. But both of these are invading camps, and one's going to invade the other, and one's going to win, and you decide which. But I can tell you this, if you try to serve only one master in God, He will win. If you try to serve two masters, the money will win every time. So he says, you can't serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other. He will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. For this reason, I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? Now, some people use this passage to say, well, I'm just not going to work at all. Well, that's disobedient, because the Word tells us to work. It's not good for a man, especially, not to be employed. It's unhealthy for a man's soul not to be working and to doing something productive. Okay? So to think, well, I'm just going to trust God for everything. I'm not going to work anymore. Well, that's disobedience. That is disobedience. You're to work. You're not to worry. And he says, verse 28, and why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will He not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, what will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, for your heavenly Father knows you need all these things. So here's the solution. Seek first and foremost and primarily and number one with all of your heart, soul, and strength the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Seek His kingdom. What is His kingdom? His kingdom is doing His will on earth the way it's done in heaven. That's what His kingdom is. Because Yeshua, when He teaches His disciples to pray, He prays, may your kingdom come. And what is that? May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we seek. And we seek His righteousness. That means obedience to His commandments. That's what it means. And when money, the pursuit of money, interferes with that, then you need to say no to the money. Period. And God promises us through Yeshua's words that if you seek first His kingdom, His righteousness, all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. So going back to James, what does he say? A double-souled man is unstable in all his ways, but the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower... Isn't that... Didn't we just read that in Yeshua's words? And its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. Now that's a curious verse, back in verses 9 and 10. But the brother of humble circumstances, the poor man, is to glory in his high position. And the rich man is to glory in his humiliation. How can that be? Because maybe you're here and you're one of the poor brethren, or maybe you're here and you're one of the rich brethren. What's the key to this? How can both of you enjoy what James tells us to enjoy? And I think the key to that is Judgment Day. When you think of Judgment Day, don't think of condemnation. We always hear Judgment Day being taught and preached as a very negative thing, a thing to be dreaded. But remember, and I keep trying to emphasize this so everybody should know this, Judgment Day, the judgment, is a neutral thing. It's your day in court. It's the day when those wonderful things you've done in secret are proclaimed openly and you're rewarded. It's the day when those terrible things you've done in secret are brought forth and you're embarrassed. It's the day when the innocent victim has everything restored. It's the day when the victimizer has things taken away. It's your day in court. It's the day when everything is made right. You can think of Judgment Day as the great leveler. Because on Judgment Day, the seesaw goes to level. And those who've been low and poor and beat down this world, they're going to be elevated. That is, if they've been making right decisions. And the rich man, if he looks forward to Judgment Day, all of a sudden his security and his riches is taken away and he can glory in the fact, all this physical stuff's going to go away. It's only the spiritual that I've accomplished that matters. If we keep in our mind this life here is temporal, the one to come is eternal, and there's a Judgment Day between now and then, and on Judgment Day everything's leveled, then the poor man can face the future with joy and live this life out with joy. The rich man can look forward with humility, and he can glory in the fact that all this stuff I've been blessed with is still just stuff. So let me use it for his kingdom. Let me give it. Let me invest it in the people around me. You understand? But if your focus isn't on the world to come and on the Judgment Day that's right around the corner, then the poor man's just going to be miserable, and the rich man's going to be proud and arrogant. But focus on what's to come. Focus on that, and everything goes to level. Everything goes even. And that's when the rich man and the poor man can fellowship together now. They can love one another now. There's no jealousy or pride involved, but they're true brothers. You follow? And as we go on in James, as he talks about the rich man, the poor man, he goes back to the teaching about trials and testings. We talked about this last week, and you find this in the opening verses of James 1. He says, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. Now remember, trials or testings are things that come at you from the outside. Someone unloads on you with anger. Someone belittles you because of your faith or something you did right. Someone won't talk to you because they're jealous. Someone dies. Or you experience a terrible loss, illness, or death of a loved one. You know, trials come at us. They just do. We don't look for them. They just find their way to us. And God assigns them to us at the right time and the right amount. You can't help that. This is part of what Yeshua is talking about. You know, the bad things, the unpleasant things we experience each day. Each day has its amount of unpleasant things, if its own trials. But there's a warning when you face a trial. And let's go on with verse 12. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of what? Of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Love of God is what will give you strength to make it through the trials. Love of him. Let no one say when he is tested, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each man is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Now what is given to the man or woman who endures trial? Back up in verse 12. A crown of what? Life. But the person who doesn't endure the trial, but instead, he takes that trial and allows his wicked heart to turn it into a temptation, and he gives birth to that temptation and a sin. What is accomplished? Death. Enduring testing leads to life. Taking the test that comes at you and turn it around and then giving it back. When someone's angry at you, becoming angry in return. Someone says something to you, say it back to them. Someone treats you with coldness, you treat them with coldness. Someone gives you the silent treatment, you give them the silent treatment. Someone hurts you, you hurt back. then the testing is turned into a temptation that you've caved into. And what's the result of that? Death. You follow? If the overhead was working, you'd see up there four easy steps to achieving death. And here they are. The first one is lust. Every single one of us has lust in our hearts. We are fallen creatures. We come to this world with a yetzer hara, which is Hebrew for an evil inclination. It's built in. It's part of us. And God has allowed us to have it because we can use it for His good. He gives it to us so we can resist it. It's like weight training. You want to build up muscles? Using air weights doesn't help. Using real ones does. As you resist the pull of gravity, your muscles get stronger. The yetzer hara is our weight training spiritually. Every one of us has that. Now, the word lust, we always think of sex when we hear the word lust. But the Greek word for lust simply means a strong desire. A strong desire. That's why in Galatians it can say that the spirit lusts against the flesh and the flesh lusts against the spirit. It means the spirit has strong desires that are contrary to the desires of the flesh. And the flesh has strong desires contrary to the desires of the spirit. You follow? So don't just think sexual desire. It's whatever kind of strong desire that is inappropriate, that is in your heart, then that's already there. The second step is temptation. You've got the desire, but temptation is when you get the opportunity. You follow? You may have a strong desire for chocolate ice cream, but you're not really tempted until it's put in front of you. You follow? So the next thing is temptation. And when a test comes, to say someone speaks something angry and unfair to you, you don't want that. And right away, now the opportunity comes up from the wickedness in your heart to say something angry back. If you have self-control, you won't. You'll absorb the insult. You'll turn the other cheek, as Messiah talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. But if you cave in and that test becomes a temptation and you give in to it, the third step then is sin. Because now you've done something you shouldn't have done. You have violated a commandment. You stepped over a line. What was a potential became a temptation, then became a reality. And then the fourth step is death. That doesn't mean you fall over dead right then, but you've broken connection. You've broken connection with God, and you've also broken connection with that other person who may have insulted you. When you turn the other cheek, there's still a possibility of making connection. When you go the second mile, you can still make connection. You're still building the bridge from your side of the gap. They may be destroying it over there, but you're still building. But when you speak back the way they've spoken to you, you've broken connection with that person as well. And there's death. Death means separation. Now, let's go ahead and finish up this passage here and read it one more time. Blessed, verse 12, is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. A crown is something that's given to a victor. And when we see testings coming, what is our attitude to be? Verse 2, go back to verse 2. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials and testings. That is to be our attitude when testings come our way. Joy. Why? The Beatitudes. Are you in mourning because of a loss? Yeshua says, blessed, happy, contented are those who mourn, for they're going to be comforted. What if someone persecutes you for something you did right, persecutes for your faith, makes fun of you because you eat kosher or you keep the Sabbath? Yeshua says, oh, rejoice and be exceedingly glad. This is the way they treat the prophets, and great is your reward in heaven. What if someone gives you the silent treatment, turns a cold shoulder to you? Yeshua says, blessed are the peacemakers. They'll be called the sons of God. You see, he shows the joy that lies on the other side of enduring the testing, of going through the testing. He says, this is what awaits you. I mean, this is good stuff here. Go through it. But if you don't have any testings, you don't get to experience the crown of life. So when you come to a testing, say, okay, it's a test. I'm going to ace it. Don't get all emotionally involved with the people, with their emotions when they pour out and they spew on you. Instead, keep your eye on God. Say, okay, God, this is a test I didn't see coming. But every day has its own testings. So I'm going to ace this one. You put a smile on your face and you do what Messiah says. You pray for those who speak evil against you. You bless those who despitefully use you. That's the proper response. That is a natural response, a supernatural response. But to respond with a sinful response is inhuman and it's unnatural. It's against the man and woman that God's made you to be. You're acting like an animal then. Let's behave like Messiah. So what are the kinds of temptations that might come our way? Here they are. You should make a list of these. We've already seen love of money, and James has spoken about that up in verses 9 through 11. You need to be very careful. And you know that the love of money is often mistranslated. We say it's the root of all evil. No, it's not the root of all evil. It's a root of all kinds of evil. In other words, love of money has produced every kind of evil that there has ever been produced. But there are other sins that produce those evils as well. But the love of money is a root of every single kind. Okay? When you love money, you're opening the entire Walmart of possible evil outcomes. Okay? It's a root of every kind of evil you can imagine. But here's some others. I want you to write them down. Anger. Lust. I'm talking about sexual lust here. Adultery. Ego. Revenge. And hate. These six, anger, lust, adultery, ego, revenge, and hate. And you may say, well, Grant, why'd you pick those six? My answer is, I didn't. Yeshua did in the Sermon on the Mount. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 5. In chapter 5 of Matthew, Yeshua quotes the Torah six times, and his six quotes from the Torah align with these six temptations. So just as James is going through and he's talking about trials and blessings and joy, Yeshua gives us the Beatitudes and how to respond to trials with joy. And then James begins to talk about the testings, the temptations we have, and how we're to endure and to have victory over these. So we have a crown of life. And Yeshua, what he does next is he talks about the Torah. He talks about the Torah and how he did not come to set the Torah aside, but to fill it. And then he gives us six examples of temptations and quotes the Torah six times on how to combat these temptations. Now, Yeshua starts with the discussion of the Torah, and then he quotes it in regards to temptations. James talks about temptations, and then the final part of chapter 1, he'll talk about the Torah and keeping it. All right? And we'll see that next week. But let's take a look at Matthew chapter 5. We have plenty of time to get to that now. Verse 20. This is the context for these six quotes that Yeshua quotes from the Torah. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. It's very important to understand that when Yeshua is quoting the Torah these six times about these six temptations, he does so because these are things that the spiritual leaders, religious leaders of that time were all guilty of. They were all guilty of these. Now, they wouldn't break the letter of the law, but they broke the spirit of it over and over and over and over again. So that's the context for this. We want to read these in that context. Another thing we want to do is this. In Perkei Avot, that portion of the Hebrew writings that we read between Passover and Pentecost, this wonderful book of wisdom, And if you have a Jewish prayer book, it's in there. It'll be in the back somewhere. Wonderful words of wisdom. It's quoted about 150 times in the New Testament. In there, in the first chapter, Pirkei Avot, it tells us to build a fence around the Torah. In other words, when you have a commandment, to make sure you don't break that commandment, distance yourself from the possibility of breaking that commandment. Put a fence around the commandment. And if you don't get in the fence, you can't break the commandment. And this is good advice. Unfortunately, the Orthodox Jews have only put up physical fences. Physical fences. And this is why Judaism has become so heavy and legalistic. Because they'll take a commandment, put a fence around it, put a fence around the fence, and the fence around the fence around the fence around the commandment. So finally, they've added all these other commandments that are in the Bible and becomes a yoke, as Peter said, that neither our fathers can bear nor can we. And Yeshua condemned this practice. He says, you tie heavy burdens on people's shoulders, but you won't lift one finger to help alleviate it. So Yeshua gives us fences, but his fences are all internal ones. Internal ones. He says, if you guard against this attitude in your heart, if you guard against this thought in your mind, you're not going to break that commandment. So watch for this as you go. His fences are internal, spiritual fences, because the Torah is spiritual. As Paul says, it's holy, it's spiritual, and it's good. So the fences we build should be spiritual fences. So let's take the first one. Verse 21. You have heard that the ancients were told, quote, you shall not commit murder, unquote. And that is from Exodus 20, verse 13. You shall not murder. King James got it dead wrong when he says, thou shalt not kill. Because later in the chapter, and in chapter 21 of Exodus, we are commanded to kill certain kinds of people. All right? But the word there is different. The word in Exodus 20, 13 is murder. You shall not murder. And the Pharisees were not guilty of murdering, except for Yeshua, of course. And then some of his apostles later. Yeshua says, you've heard it said, you shall not murder. And whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. In other words, if you're never angry with anyone, you're not going to be murdering them. You're not going to murder somebody you're not angry with. It's anger, that internal attitude of anger, that can lead to murder, leads to hatred. And how does it work? I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother, it doesn't say angry without a cause, just angry. You might have good reason to be angry. Don't cave into it. Everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, empty head is what it really means, you empty head, you dummy, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough for the fires of Gehenna. The sages have a lot to say about anger. And it's interesting that Yeshua speaks of this, and I think more than the other five temptations, because it's the most caustic. They say it's a disease of the soul. It's like a cancer that eats away your soul, but it's a contagious one, because it'll eat at others as well. It can burn in them. They say the heat that you feel when you get angry, that is the very fire of hell that you are feeling in your heart. That's what it feels like. You want to know what hell is like? Think of the last time you got so angry you were just burning inside. That is hell, and it's in your heart. Solomon tells us that anger resides in the heart of a fool. And a man or woman who is given to anger is a fool. They don't have any wisdom. Because wisdom cannot dwell in the heart of an angry man. It can't. They say that an angry man is an idol worshiper. They go further and say an angry man has no God. And I can think of times when I lost my temper. I'm pretty good at not losing my temper. I have a slow burn a lot of times. But just to blow up is something you don't want to see. It's very rare, thank God. Robin has seen it. But I tell you, when I get angry, and you know what it is, you lose your temper. You throw all the commandments out the window. God doesn't exist anymore. You're going to say what you're going to say. You're going to do what you're going to do. And everything else, and just go take a leap. Angry man has no God. Anger is a terrible, terrible disease of the soul. And it's best never to be angry at all. The scriptures do say, be angry and sin not. But there's a warning that goes with it. And I'd say before you try to obey that verse, try to obey, don't be angry ever anyway. And if you get to the place where you can stay not angry, then at that point you can begin to introduce a proper anger without sinning. But first of all, learn how not to be angry at all. God is not an angry God, but he's capable of anger. And every once in a while, he shows his anger. But the psalmist says his anger is only for a very short time. But it's measured and it's perfect and it's born out of love and out of wisdom. He never loses control. Yeshua demonstrated anger. He drove the money changers out of the temple on two occasions. And it's premeditated. He made a whip of cords. He knew what he was going to do. He planned for it, prepared for it. He went in there and he demonstrated anger. But he didn't sin. So absolute iron-fisted control of your own soul is necessary before you can have the measured quality of anger. That's a righteous anger. First of all, rid your soul of unrighteous anger before you think, well, I'll be angry. I'll just be careful not to sin. You'll sin. He goes on, verse 23, therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, not that you did something to him, he has something against you. Leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. In other words, an angry person has no right whatsoever to be involved in religious service. And if you're an angry man and you hold a position in your church or at Beth Tikkun, you need to step down. Go get that taken care of first, then come back. But sometimes people who lose their temper on the one hand, they want to cover it up with some kind of a religious service on the other. No. God doesn't accept it. He will not accept that. If your anger has caused your brother to have something against you, you better make it right with that person before you pray, before you start trying to read your Bible or teach or do anything else. Because it means nothing to anybody and means nothing to God until you make things right with your brother. If you've broken fellowship with your brother or sister, repair that before you try to go back and repair your relationship with God. Yes, Adam, see a hand up here. Now, what's a technique for not getting angry? I knew somebody asked this question. Here's my simple answer. You don't get angry the same way you choose to turn your car right instead of left. You turn the wheel. You do it. It's a switch you flip. You just do it. Someone flares up at you. You have all this reason to be angry, and you decide, I'm not going to be angry. That's what it is. What we've been deceived by the enemy into thinking, oh, you can't help it. You're angry. You have a right to be angry. You got to vent it. You got to talk about it. No, you don't. Don't be angry. Period. And if we weren't capable of doing what I'm just saying here, we wouldn't be commanded not to be angry. So if he's commanded us, don't be angry. We have the ability to not be angry. We need to make that choice. But I tell you what, every time we cave into anger, harder and harder and harder it gets to turn off the flow. So let's start early. Let's start with the little things. Let's turn it off. Let's not give in to it. Because anger eventually leads to murder. Yes, Ben.
Yesterday I had a more angry day than I normally do.
Can you imagine Ben Alger angry? I guess. Demonstrate. We want to see how this went.
And so for me, if
Yeah. That's good. So, Ben, if you probably people in the who might be sitting out on the periphery couldn't hear you, and people on the CD, Ben was sharing that if you, he tends to get angry when he has expectations for a day or for an event, and they don't pan out. So, be prepared to change your expectations. Yeah. It's like steering a car again. You know, you never can tell someone's going to run out in front of you. You got to change your course. Yeah. So. Yes, Brian. Yeah. Yes. Great advice. Brian was just sharing that just be quiet. Don't talk back right away. And take some time. Take a day or two before you answer. But see, a person who is capable of being quiet and waiting a couple of days is a person who's chosen not to get angry. You see? So those are proper responses for someone who has self-control. That is, those are indications you do have control. So, yeah. But it's very practical. Just keep your mouth shut. All right. Yes.
I'd like to piggyback on both things that were
sure.
Sometimes it's your own inferiority.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe if you're looking another way and staying quiet and asking God, you know, what's really going on here?
Yeah.
I had a situation where that happened, and I had it was like an aha moment. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Yes.
I needed something, and I needed to get it out, but I did it with God, and then I was able to go to that person and ask for what I needed, and they were able to give it to me.
Right.
And,
very good.
What Ben said, you know, there's a little prayer that I say. It's like, today I can accept God has the world exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I can accept it.
Yeah.
You know,
very good. Thank you, Mary Jo. I wish I could repeat all that back for the people on the microphone here, but I can't. But that was good. Good wisdom. Thanks for sharing that. All right, let's move on, because we've got quite a bit of ground to cover yet, and we want to get out of here on time. Verse 25, make friends quickly. We like to get angry quickly. No, make friends quickly with your opponent at law, while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge, and the judge the officer, and you be thrown into prison. And the things that Yeshua is saying here are not just literal things, but they're also spiritual things, they're figurative. Truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid the uttermost farthing, the King James says, or until you have paid up the last cent. In other words, when you have blown up on somebody, there is a price to pay, and you will pay it. Judgment day is coming, and you will pay the last penny of what you owe for what you did. And then he goes to another quote from the Torah, verse 27. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. That's Exodus 20, verse 14. Now, so far, he's quoted two of the commandments. The first one is, thou shalt not kill, or not murder. The second is, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You see how he's building an internal fence again? He's not disagreeing with the commandment. He's not saying the commandment's wrong. The commandment's right. But he's saying, here's the protection. Let's back up. You're not going to commit adultery with someone you haven't looked at lustfully. So don't look lustfully at someone. You see? Protect your eyes. Protect your heart and your attitudes. There's no chance you're going to be committing adultery with that person. But when you let your eyes begin to wander and nest on somebody, and then you allow your imagination to begin to fill in what it would be like to be with that person, you're walking down a road, you're going to think, well, I'll go down a little bit halfway and stop there. It's better. Don't even go down the road at all. You don't have to worry about, can I turn around halfway down the road? Verse 29, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into Gehenna. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, one of the things Yeshua is doing here is a very common teaching technique in Judaism, then and now, and Yeshua employs it many times. And that technique is called hyperbole. Hyperbole. What you do is you take a point, and to drive the point home, you exaggerate it. Okay? Now, as long as the listener understands what you're doing, there's no deception here. It's like when you tell a child, I've told you a million times, don't play in the street. Now, you didn't tell them a million times. And they know that you didn't tell them a million times. But you both understand what you mean. You understand? So you haven't lied with your lips. The exaggeration you're using is to drive home how important it is that the child not play in the street. So Yeshua does this all the time because the hearer understood what the teacher was saying, and so there's no deception involved. And he says, unless you hate your mother and father, you're not worthy of following me. He doesn't want you hating your mom and dad. But what he's saying is your love for your parents compared to your love for me would almost look like hatred compared to love. When he talks about cutting off your right hand, plucking out your eye, you're not supposed to do that. Your body is a tabernacle of God's Spirit. You're to treat it with as a steward treats a gift that is entrusted to him. He's using hyperbole, and understand that. And so you'll see this over and over and over again in Yeshua's teachings. Again, there's no misdirection. There's no deception involved. The hearer understood what he was doing. And in Jewish teaching, this is a common practice. They all understand it. In fact, I think it's the Talmud that talks about your right hand offending you. He says, cut it off at the waist. All right? Don't just cut it off at the wrist or the shoulder. Cut it off at the waist. Cut off your entire top half. That's hyperbole. You understand? One of the things that that the Pharisees would never do is commit adultery. They would never take a woman who is already married. But as the next quote will reveal, they found a loophole in the Torah. Verse 31, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce, unquote. And that is directly from Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 and 3, and other places in the Torah. And it says, if a man divorces his wife, he writes out a certificate of divorce and gives it to her. Do you see the grace, the mercy, and the love that's in this commandment? See, we read that commandment and think, oh, that's so terrible. No, it's not. You see, in those days, a man could have more than one wife. And so, a man has a wife, and he has another wife, and then he picks a third wife. But a wife could only have one husband, one at a time, one husband. And so before a man would marry a woman, he had to have proof that she was single. Now, if she lived with her parents at home, then they could vouch for the fact that she's single. She's not married to anybody. She's not engaged. She's available. And then they go from there. But if the woman's parents are dead, and if the woman maybe even has a child of her own, that man must have proof that she is single before he takes her, because if he takes a married woman, he's committed adultery. And so it's telling the man here, if you divorce your wife, be merciful to her. You give her that certificate of divorce so that she has proof that she is now single and she can be married to someone else. It's an act of mercy. It's an act of love. You follow? Another thing you have to keep in mind is back then, and in the Torah, you can study this in the Torah, a man could divorce a woman for one reason only, and Yeshua quotes it here in a moment. And the reason for that, and the Hebrew word is a little bit vague. It has to do with some kind of an impurity. That's about the best we can translate it. The Greek translates it with the word porneo, which is where we get our word pornography. And they attach sexual immorality or sexual impurity to it. The Hebrew word isn't a sexual word, though. And in fact, when it's used in Exodus 21, I believe it's Exodus 21, where the chapter before uses the word when it has to do with when you go, you're in the wilderness and you go out and you use the bathroom. They didn't have bathrooms, your imagination. You're going to take a shovel and cover what you leave, because he did not want to see this impurity in your camp. All right? So the Hebrew word doesn't have a sexual connotation, though it can be used that way. So honestly, we're a little bit vague as to what the word really means. But a man could divorce his wife for only one reason. That's because this was found in her, this kind of impurity. All right? And we're going to leave it there. We could spend hours trying to figure out what that is, but I want to move on. But the woman, the Torah gives the woman three conditions under which she can get a divorce. If the man doesn't feed her, doesn't provide her food. If he doesn't provide her clothing, that refers to protection and shelter as well. And if he does not provide sexual relationships with her. If he denies her any one of those three, she can divorce the husband. And the Torah says you give her a certificate of divorce if she asks it. Because why does she get more liberty to divorce the husband than the husband does to divorce the woman? It's because the man is not dependent upon the woman for his food, for his clothing, and for his sexual relations. He can have a number of wives. But she, on the other hand, is dependent upon him for all of these things. And if he doesn't provide them, she can walk. And you can find that in Exodus 21, verses 10 and 11. And so, the commandment is, if there's a divorce, and also think about this, in the Torah, the mercy that gives the wife the right to divorce a husband who's not providing for her. That's unheard of in the ancient world. But this is God's word. Now, I know that later in Matthew 19, some people challenge Yeshua concerning divorce and remarriage. And you can read the entire passage there. But Yeshua talks about divorce, and he says that, you know, Malachi says God hates divorce, and he does. He hates divorce. Under any conditions, he hates it, hates it, hates it. But he has permitted it, Yeshua says, because of the hardness of your hearts. In other words, divorce was permitted for the protection of the innocent party. So you have a man and a woman. One of them really messes up. One of them has violated the covenant in such a way that the Torah permits a divorce. And it permits the divorce so that the innocent party can be protected. Usually the innocent one is the woman. So he permits divorce. That woman doesn't have to live in a house of horrors. We've heard that a lot in the news lately, haven't we? But she doesn't have to live under these inhumane conditions. She can leave. And the certificate of divorce was given to her so that she could remarry. That's its entire purpose. It had no purpose other than that. That's what the divorce papers were for. And I know I've heard stories of people who have believed that when you divorce, you cannot remarry until your ex is dead. And I've heard wonderful testimonies of people who've clung to that. I've heard more horror stories about people who've clung to that. Of destroyed testimonies, destroyed families. Children have completely walked away from God because they've seen, if this is what God does, then I want nothing to do with it, because they've seen their moms become literally floor mats to an abusive husband. So we need to look at this as what Yeshua is teaching in the context of the Torah. Everything he taught was in the context of the Torah. If he taught something contrary to the Torah, he's not the Messiah. So first and foremost, the Torah comes first, and Yeshua speaks within that context. All right? He never taught against it. Now let's look at the rest of his words. Verse 32, but I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, who's doing the divorcing here? The man. Except for the reason of, and here my translation says on chastity, it's that Hebrew word, okay? That thing that's referred to back in Exodus. Except for that reason. See, Yeshua is holding up the Torah. Anyone who divorces his wife, except for that one condition the Torah gives for him to divorce her, he makes her commit adultery. She's not guilty. He's the one God's going to hold guilty. And then whoever marries this divorced woman commits adultery. Not her, him. You know what the Pharisees did back in those days? They would never dream of committing adultery. But the Torah provided this thing where you could divorce your wife and just give her a bill of a divorce, divorce papers. So two Pharisees get together and say, you know, I got a good-looking wife here, but I'm kind of tired of her. You've got a good-looking wife. Tired of her yet? Yeah, I am, kind of. Let's divorce them, you know, and then we'll marry each other. Okay. And this went on all the time. So what they were actually doing was committing adultery through a loophole of the Torah. You follow? And the people who heard Yeshua say this knew exactly who he was talking to. And remember the verse that came before these six quotes? Verse 20, I say to you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll not enter the kingdom of heaven. Oh, they're keeping the letter of the law, but they are stomping all over the spirit of it. They may not be committing legal adultery, but spiritual adultery and adultery in their hearts, oh yeah, they're practitioners of it. You understand what's being said? All right. Verse 33, here we come to our fourth quote. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, quote, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to Adonai, unquote. This is Leviticus 19:2. But I say to you, make no vow at all. There's your fence. See, if you make a verbal vow, you better fulfill it. God takes no pleasure in fools. And if you don't fulfill it, there are consequences to pay. It's better not to make any vows at all. What should you do instead? I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God. Because people swear by heaven. Heaven is a what they call an evasive pronoun referring to God. Don't swear by God. Don't swear by heaven. It's the throne of God himself. Don't swear by the earth. I swear by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet. Or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head. By my head I swear, people sometimes say. For you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond this is evil, or from the evil one. Remember that one temptation we listed? I put ego. This is the one that's assigned to ego. Now, anyone who has to go beyond saying, yes, I'll do that, or no, I'm not going to do that. Anyone who goes beyond that, saying, oh, I'll do that, I promise you, you can count on it, I'm going to. Why do you have to add all this other stuff on? Maybe because in the past you haven't followed through on your yeses and nos, and now you have to bolster them up with more words. More often than not, we add all this other stuff. I swear to God. We do that out of pure ego. We do it out of pure ego. In other words, we want to impress someone with something we've seen, with something we've experienced. We say, I swear to God, this is what happened. All of a sudden, we've lifted ourselves up, and God is simply something to exist for the purpose of coming to bolster up the things we've seen, to prop up our tall tale. That's all ego. It's all ego. Humbly say yes and follow through on it, or humbly say no and then don't do it. Keep it simple, and you'll never make a false oath ever in your life. And then we come to verse 38. He quotes the Torah again. He quotes Exodus 21:24. He says, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, unquote. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to who asks of you. Do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Now, what's the context of this eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? It's found actually 3 times in the Torah. Exodus 21, 22 to 25 says this, when men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her child come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. All right? What does happen? A pregnant woman got hit. She gave birth. The baby survived. But the guy who hit her, even by accident, is going to be fined. He's going to pay money to make up for the damages he's done. And then the next verse says, but if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. What this is about is this. It's not about you did something to me, so I get to do it back to you. You knocked out my tooth? All right, come here. You knocked out your tooth. Now we're even. That's not what it's saying. What it's saying is this. If I knock out your tooth, whether on purpose or by accident, then I need to pay a tooth for that tooth. I need to make it up to you, and the judges will establish what the fine is. If I burn you, either on purpose or by accident, a fine will be determined, and I will pay for that damage. What it is, it's not a license to take revenge. It's a commandment dealing with my own responsibilities for the harm I may cause other people, by accident even. And if I cause damage, I pay for the damage. Period. So if I knock out a tooth, I pay for the tooth. If I knock out an eye, I pay for the eye. If I cause a burn, I pay for the burn. But burning me doesn't help that person get well. You understand? And that is what the context is all three times it's found in the Torah. It's about personal responsibility for the harm I cause. Not for taking revenge on somebody who does something to me. But by the time Yeshua speaks these words, it had been twisted around to where it became a license to take revenge. And Yeshua is simply not disagreeing with the Torah, but replacing it back to the proper context. And so he says in verse 39, I see you do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, don't say, oh, I get to slap you now. Don't take vengeance. Turn the other cheek. Now, this doesn't mean you can turn someone else's cheek. When I see someone else being harmed, slapped around, I'm commanded to step in and protect that innocent person. Somebody can slap me and insult me, and I take it. But when someone's insulting, attacking someone else, I need to step in and do something. I can turn my own cheek. I can't turn somebody else's. And this verse has been so abused, misused, and misapplied to where people become pacifist, and they even say, yeah, if somebody came to my house with a gun and held it on my wife and kids and killed them, I can't kill them, and I just can't do it. Are you kidding me? As far as I'm concerned, anyone who would stand by and let his family or other innocent people be killed and not step in with a gun to shoot the bad guy, I think they're just as guilty as murderers as the guy who's pulling the trigger. That's just my own opinion. And I'm not angry about it. I just want you to understand. And then our sixth quote, because our time is gone. Verse 43. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor. And that is a quote from Leviticus 19:18. But this last part, and hate your enemy, is nowhere in the Bible. It's not in the Torah. And I think that what you should do is put parentheses around that. I think when Yeshua taught, this is my own imagination, I think when he was teaching the sermon, he was saying, and you've heard it said, you shall love your enemy, or love your neighbor, and hate your enemies. I think that's how he taught it. Because I think a lot of people kind of implied, I'm to love my neighbor. Oh yeah, I know that. The Bible tells me that. But there's no commandment that says I can't hate my enemies, so I'll just go ahead and hate them. It says love my neighbor. It doesn't say anything about loving my enemies. So Yeshua, he says, but I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. So you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. Now this is interesting. Verse 45 says, so you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. Where have we read those words before? Anybody know where we've read those? How about up in verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. See how it's come full circle? Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, people you get along with, what more are you doing than others? Don't even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you're to be perfect, complete, shalema, as your heavenly Father is complete and perfect. In other words, behave like God. God makes his rain fall on the wicked and on the good. He makes his sunshine on the just and on the unjust. Let your light shine on both. Let your blessings flow to both. And then you're like him. You follow? Now, next week, we're going to be looking at Yeshua's words earlier in chapter 5, where he says, "Don't even think I came to destroy the Torah." And then we'll look at the last part of James 1, where James says, "Be a doer of the word, not a hearer only, deceiving your own selves." We're going to take these, because James and Yeshua both comment on the Torah. But I want you to go over these six quotes, because there's something about these six quotes I want you to study this week, and that is this. Yeshua could have picked all kinds of things from the Torah to quote, but he picked these particular six. I want you to look at these six and ponder them and think about them. And one of the things you'll discover is they make a complete circuit. One leads to two leads to three leads to four, and so on. And then number six leads all the way back to number one. These six commandments, if you look at them, are a little picture of the entire Torah. And also they're a chain. And if you give in to these temptations, you'll give in to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and you'll just keep spiraling down. If you resist the temptations, you put the fences in place, you'll spiral up. But the six quotes make a loop. They make a loop. So what you can do is study and see how one progresses to the other. And that progresses to the next, to the next, to the next, and they come all the way back to number one. All right? What Yeshua has done here is beyond brilliant. And we can just read through the sermon and not realize he handpicked these six quotes because they describe six of the most common temptations, love of money being the huge one. Yeshua saves that for chapter 6. James put it before referring to these temptations. But he picked these six because they are a picture of the Torah itself. So come back next week and be prepared as we talk more about the Torah. All right? Our time is way gone, so let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time, for your word, for the brilliance of our wonderful redeeming Messiah. Thank you, Lord, for your love. Thank you for the words of Yeshua's younger half-brother, Jacob, James. And Father, I pray that we might follow in James's footsteps, continue to draw new insights out of ancient words, insights that will build and feed and strengthen one another. But Lord, above all, help us to be people who endure testing and temptations. Do not cave into them. And so when it's all said and done, we will receive a crown of life, a victory crown. So Lord, help us not to be like people of the world, but to be like your children, to live life the way you do, so that people will see your resemblance in us, your kids. And with Yeshua's help, this we will do. We ask it in his name. Amen. All right, let's